The priest, driven into a helpless position, went into the inner sanctuary before the statue and lamented over what he was in danger of suffering. Overcome by his lament, he drifted into sleep, and a vision appeared to him. The god stood over him and told him to take courage, that he would suffer no harm in meeting the Arabian army, for he himself would send him helpers. Relying on this dream, he took with him the Egyptians who were willing to follow, and encamped at Pelusium, for that is where the entrance routes are, and none of the men who followed him were fighters, but shopkeepers and craftsmen and market people. When they arrived there, field mice poured in upon their enemies by night and ate through their quivers and their bows, and besides these the handles of their shields, so that the next day, fleeing unarmed, many of them fell. And to this day this king stands in the temple of Hephaestus, made of stone, holding a mouse in his hand, and saying through an inscription, "Let whoever looks upon me be reverent." So far the Egyptians and the priests told the story, showing that between the first king and this final priest-king of Hephaestus, 341 human generations had passed, and in these there had been that many high priests and that many kings, each in their own right. Yet 300 generations of men amount to 10,000 years, for 3 generations of men make 100 years, and the remaining 41 generations, which came after the 300, make 1,340 years. So across a span of 11,340 years, they said, no god had taken human form, nor indeed did they say anything of this sort had happened either earlier or later among the remaining kings of Egypt who arose. In that time, then, they said the sun had 4 times risen out of its usual place. 2 times it rose where it now sets, and 2 times it set where it now rises. And nothing in Egypt was changed on account of this, neither what comes from the earth nor what comes from the river for them, nor anything concerning diseases or deaths. Earlier, when Hecateus the storyteller was in Thebes and traced his lineage, attaching his family line to a god in the 16th generation, the priests of Zeus did to him just what they also did to me, though I had not traced my own lineage. They led him into the great inner chamber and counted out, showing him, as many wooden colossal statues as they had said there were. For each high priest sets up there, during his own lifetime, an image of himself. Counting and showing them, the priests demonstrated to me that each one was the son of his own father, going through them all starting from the statue of whichever had died most recently, until they had shown me the whole line. And to Hecateus, when he traced his own lineage and attached it to a god in the 16th generation, they gave a counter-genealogy based on their reckoning, not accepting from him that a man could be born from a god. They gave this counter-genealogy in the following way, saying that each of the statues was a pyramus born from a pyramus, until they had shown that all 345 statues were, each one, a pyramus named after pyramus, and they did not attach them to a god or a hero at all. Pyramus in the Greek tongue means a good and noble man. Of those whose images these were then, they showed that all of them were of this sort, quite removed from gods. But before the time of these men, they said, those ruling in Egypt were gods, not existing alongside men, and of these always one held power. And the last of them to reign was Horus, son of Osiris, whom the Greeks call Apollo. He put an end to the rule of Typhon and reigned last over Egypt. Osiris, in the Greek tongue, is Dionysus. Among the Greeks, the youngest of the gods are held to be Heracles and Dionysus and Pan, but among the Egyptians Pan is the most ancient, one of the first 8 gods, as they are called, while Heracles belongs to the second group, the 12 so-called gods, and Dionysus to the third group, who were born from the 12 gods. As for Heracles, how many years the Egyptians themselves say there are down to King Amasis, I have already stated. And Pan is said to be still more ancient than these, while Dionysus is the most recent of them, and even he is reckoned to be 15,000 years before King Amasis. And the Egyptians say they know this exactly, always reckoning and always recording the years. Now, as for the Dionysus said to have been born from Semele, daughter of Cadmus, it is about 1,600 years down to my own time. As for Heracles, born of Alcmene, it comes to roughly 900 years. And as for Pan, son of Penelope, for by the Greeks it is said that Pan was born of her and Hermes, the years are fewer than those since the Trojan War, about 800 years down to my time. Anyone is free to make use of whichever of these 2 accounts seems more persuasive. As for me, I have already declared my own judgment about them. For if these figures too had become well known and had grown old in Greece, just as Heracles born of Amphitryon did, and likewise Dionysus born of Semele and Pan born of Penelope, one might say that these were other men who had come to bear the names of those gods born earlier. But as it is, the Greeks say that Dionysus, as soon as he was born, was sewn into Zeus's thigh and carried off to Nyssa, which lies above Egypt in Ethiopia, and concerning Pan they cannot say where he went once he was born. It is clear to me that the Greeks learned the names of these two later than the names of the other gods, and from the time they learned of them, from that time they reckon their birth. This much, then, is what the Egyptians themselves say, but what the rest of mankind, and the Egyptians in agreement with them, say happened in this land, this I will now relate, and something of my own observation will be added to it as well. The Egyptians, once freed after the reign of the priest of Hephaestus, for they were not able to live any length of time without a king, set up 12 kings, dividing the whole of Egypt into 12 portions. These men, having made marriage alliances with one another, ruled under the following customs: neither to overthrow one another nor to seek to have more than one's fellow, but to be the very greatest of friends. They made these rules and kept to them strictly for the following reason. It had been prophesied to them at the very outset, when they first took up their rule, that whichever of them poured a libation from a bronze bowl in the temple of Hephaestus would rule all of Egypt. For indeed they used to gather together for all the sacred rites. And they resolved to leave behind some common memorial, and having so resolved they built a labyrinth, situated a little above Lake Moeris, near the city called Crocodile City, which I myself have now seen, and it is beyond description. For if one were to reckon up the walls and the display of works made by the Greeks, they would appear to be of less labor and expense than this labyrinth. And yet the temple at Ephesus is certainly remarkable, and so is the one at Samos. The pyramids, too, were beyond description, and each of them was a match for many great works of the Greeks, yet the labyrinth surpasses even the pyramids. For it has 12 covered courts, with gates facing one another, 6 facing north and 6 facing south, all adjoining one another, with the same outer wall surrounding them all. The chambers within are double, some underground and others above ground upon them, 3,000 in number, 1,500 of each kind. The chambers above ground we ourselves saw, going through them, and speak of them from our own viewing. The underground ones we learned of only by report, for the Egyptians in charge were entirely unwilling to show them, saying that there were burial places there belonging both to the kings who first built this labyrinth and to the sacred crocodiles. So concerning the lower chambers we speak from what we heard by report, while the upper ones, greater than any human works, we ourselves saw. For the passageways through the covered halls and the winding paths through the courts, being most intricate, provided endless wonder as one passed from a court into the chambers, and from the chambers into columned halls, and from the columned halls into other chambers, and into other courts from the chambers. The roof over all of these is of stone, just as the walls are, and the walls are full of carved figures, and each court is surrounded by columns of white stone fitted together most precisely. At the corner where the labyrinth ends there stands a pyramid 40 fathoms high, on which great figures are carved, and the way into it has been made underground. Such being this labyrinth, an even greater wonder is provided by the lake called Moeris, alongside which this labyrinth is built. Its circumference measures 3,600 stadia, 60 skoine, equal to the length of Egypt itself along the sea. It lies long from north to south, and its depth, at its deepest point, is 50 fathoms. That it is man-made and dug out is shown by the lake itself, for two pyramids stand roughly at its center, rising 50 fathoms above the water, each, and an equal amount built below the water, and on top of both sits a stone colossus seated upon a throne. Thus the pyramids stand 100 fathoms high, and 100 fathoms, measured out correctly, come to a stadion of 6 plethra, the fathom being reckoned at 6 feet and 4 cubits, with each foot equal to 4 palms and each cubit to 6 palms. The water in the lake is not native to it. The region there is terribly short of water. Instead, it has been channeled in from the Nile by a canal, and for 6 months it flows into the lake, then reverses for 6 months, running back out to the Nile. And whenever it flows out, then during those 6 months, the lake yields a talent of silver a day to the royal treasury from the fish, and whenever the water flows into it, 20 minas. The local people said, and that this lake drains underground into the Syades that lies toward Libya, turned toward the west into the interior, alongside the mountain range above Memphis. Since I could not see the spoil from this digging lying anywhere, for I was quite curious about it, I asked those who lived nearest the lake where the excavated earth had gone. They told me where it had been carried off, and I found it easy to believe, since I knew by report that something similar had happened at Nineveh, the city of the Assyrians. The great wealth of Sardanapalus, king of Nineveh, was kept guarded in underground treasuries, and thieves plotted to carry it off. Starting from their own houses, the thieves tunneled underground, working their way toward the royal palace, and the earth removed from the digging they carried off, whenever night fell, to the Tigris River flowing past Nineveh, until they had accomplished what they wanted. I heard that something similar happened also with the digging of the lake in Egypt, only there the work went on during daylight hours rather than at night. As the Egyptians dug, they carried the earth to the Nile, and the river, receiving it, would disperse it. That then is how this lake is said to have been dug. Now the 12 kings, who dealt justly with one another on one occasion, when they had made sacrifice in the temple of Hephaestus, on the last day of the festival, were about to pour libations, and the high priest brought out for them the golden bowls from which they were accustomed to pour, but miscounted, bringing out 11 for the 12 of them. Then, since he had no bowl, Sametichus, who stood last of them, took off his helmet, which was of bronze, held it out, and poured his libation with it. All the other kings likewise wore helmets, and happened to have them on at that moment. Sametichus held out his helmet with no treacherous intent, but the others, taking note of what Sametichus had done, and recalling the oracle that had been given them, that whichever of them poured a libation from a bronze bowl would become sole king of Egypt, recalling this oracle, they did not see fit to kill Sametichus, since on questioning him under torture, they found he had acted with no forethought at all. But they resolved to drive him out into the marshes, stripped of most of his power, and that from the marshes he should have no dealings with the rest of Egypt. This Sametichus had previously fled from the Ethiopian Sabacos, who had killed his father Necho. He had then fled to Syria, and when the Ethiopian departed as a result of the vision seen in the dream, the Egyptians of the Sate district brought him back. Afterward, when he was king a second time, it was through the helmet that the 11 kings caused him to flee again into the marshes. Aware now that these men had treated him with such contempt, he set about taking revenge on those who had driven him out. He sent to the city of Buto, to the Oracle of Leto, where the Egyptians have their most truthful place of divination, and the oracle came back that vengeance would arrive from the sea, when men of bronze appeared. He found this very hard to believe, that men of bronze should come to his aid. But not much time passed before necessity drove Ionian and Carian men, out raiding, to be carried off course to Egypt. And when they disembarked and, armed in bronze, one of the Egyptians who had come to the marshes reported to Sametichus, since he had never before seen men armed in bronze, that men of bronze had arrived from the sea and were ravaging the countryside. Sametichus, realizing that the oracle was being fulfilled, made friends with the Ionians and Carians, and by promising them great rewards, persuaded them to join him. Once he had persuaded them, backed by the Egyptians who wanted his cause to succeed as well as by these allies, he overthrew the kings. Having gained control of all Egypt, Sametichus built for Hephaestus the forecourt at Memphis that faces the south wind, and a courtyard for Apis, in which Apis is kept whenever he appears, building it opposite the forecourt, the whole surrounded by columns and filled with reliefs. In place of columns, there stand colossal statues 12 cubits high supporting the courtyard. Apis, in the Greek tongue, is Epaphus. To the Ionians and Carians who had helped him accomplish this, Sametichus gave lands to dwell in, opposite one another, with the Nile flowing between them. These were given the name encampments. He gave them these lands and everything else that he had promised, all of it. He also placed Egyptian boys with them to learn the Greek language, and from these, once they had learned the language, the interpreters now found in Egypt are descended. The Ionians and Carians dwelt in these lands for a long time. These lands lie by the coast, a short way below Bubastes, on the mouth of the Nile called Pelusiac. These men King Amasis later removed from there and resettled at Memphis, making them his own guard against the Egyptians. Since these people were settled in Egypt, the Greeks, by mingling with them, have come to know accurately everything that has happened concerning Egypt from the reign of King Psammetichus onward, including later events. For these were the first people of a foreign tongue to be settled in Egypt. From the places from which they were removed, the beached hulls of their ships and the ruins of their dwellings remain down to my own time. This, then, is how Psammetichus gained control of Egypt. Of the oracle in Egypt I have already made mention many times, and I shall now give an account of it, since it deserves one. This oracle in Egypt is a sanctuary of Leto, situated in a great city by the mouth of the Nile called the Sebennytic, as one sails up from the sea. This city, where the oracle stands, bears the name Buto, as I have already called it before. In this Buto there is a sanctuary of Apollo and Artemis, and the temple of Leto, in which the oracle is housed, is itself quite large and has a forecourt 10 fathoms high. But of the visible things there, I shall tell you what struck me as the greatest marvel. In this precinct there is a temple of Leto made from a single stone, equal in height and length, each wall of it 40 cubits, each measurement the same, and as a roof covering another stone is set on top, with a cornice 4 cubits deep. This temple, then, is the most marvelous of the visible things around this sanctuary that I know of, and second is the island called Chemes. It lies in a deep, wide lake beside the sanctuary at Buto, and the Egyptians say this island is a floating one. I myself never saw it floating or moving, and I am amazed to hear it, if it is really a floating island. On it there stands a great temple of Apollo, and 3 altars are set up, and there grow on it many palm trees and other trees, both fruit-bearing and barren, in abundance. The Egyptians tell the following story to explain why it is a floating island. That on this island, which was not floating before, Leto, one of the 8 gods born at the very beginning, dwelling in the city of Buto, where indeed this oracle of hers is, received Apollo in trust from Isis, and preserved him by hiding him on the island now called Floating, at the time when Typhon came searching everywhere, wishing to find the child of Osiris. Apollo and Artemis, they say, are children of Dionysus and Isis, and Leto became their nurse and savior. In the Egyptian tongue, Apollo is Horus, Demeter is Isis, and Artemis is Bubastes. It was from this story, and no other, that Aeschylus, son of Euphorion, took the idea I shall now mention, alone among the poets who came before, for he made Artemis the daughter of Demeter. And this, they say, is why the island became a floating one. This is what they say. Psammetichus ruled Egypt for 54 years, 29 of which he spent besieging the great Syrian city of Azotus, until he took it. This Azotus held out under siege longer than any other city we know of. Necho, son of Psammetichus, became king of Egypt after him, and he was the first to attempt the canal leading to the Red Sea, which Darius the Persian later dug a second time. Its length is a 4 days' voyage, and it was dug wide enough for 2 triremes to be rowed abreast. The water for it is brought from the Nile, drawn from a point a little above the city of Bubastes, past Potamus, the Arabian city, and it empties into the Red Sea. It was dug first through the part of the Egyptian plain that lies toward Arabia, and above this plain runs the mountain range extending toward Memphis, in which the stone quarries are. Along the base of this mountain the canal was brought, running long from west to east, and then it extends into the gorges, running from the mountain toward the south and the south wind, down to the Arabian Gulf. Now the shortest and most direct route to cross from the northern sea to the southern, which is also called the Red Sea, is from Mount Cassius, which marks the boundary between Egypt and Syria. From there, it is exactly 1,000 stadia to the Arabian Gulf. That is the most direct route, but the canal is much longer, inasmuch as it is more winding. In the digging of it under King Necho, 120,000 Egyptians perished. Necho stopped digging partway through when an oracle intervened forbidding it, on the grounds that he was laboring in advance for the foreigner. The Egyptians call all people who do not share their language foreigners. Having ceased work on the canal, Necho turned to military campaigns, and triremes were built, some for the Northern Sea, others in the Arabian Gulf on the Red Sea, and the slipways for them are still visible today. Necho used these ships when he needed them, and he also fought the Syrians on land, defeating them at Magdalus, and after the battle he took Catades, a great city of Syria. The clothing he happened to be wearing when he accomplished these things he dedicated to Apollo, sending it to the Branchidae, the sanctuary of the Milesians. After this, having ruled 16 years in all, he died, handing over the kingdom to his son Sammes. It was during the reign of this Sammes over Egypt that messengers from Elis arrived, boasting that they administered the contest at Olympia more justly and more nobly than anyone else in the world, and supposing that not even the Egyptians, wise as they were reputed to be, could devise anything better in this matter. When the Eleans arrived in Egypt and explained the reason for which they had come, the king summoned together those of the Egyptians said to be the wisest. The Egyptians, once assembled, questioned the Eleans, who told them everything that fell to them to do concerning the contest. Having recounted it all, they said they had come to learn whether the Egyptians could devise anything more just than this. The Egyptians deliberated, and then asked the Eleans whether their own citizens competed in it. They answered that both they themselves and the other Greeks alike were permitted to compete, whoever wished. The Egyptians said that in arranging things this way they had missed the mark of justice entirely, for there was no way they would fail to favor their own citizen when he competed, thereby wronging the foreigner. But if they truly wished to arrange it justly, and this was the reason they had come to Egypt, the Egyptians urged them instead to open the contest to foreign competitors only, and let no Elean to be allowed to compete. This is the advice the Egyptians gave the Eleans. Sammes, after ruling Egypt only 6 years and campaigning against Ethiopia, died soon after, and Apries, son of Sammes, succeeded him. He, after his ancestor Psammetichus, was the most fortunate of the earlier kings, ruling 25 years, during which he sent an army against Sidon and fought a naval battle against the Tyrian. But since it was fated that he come to a bad end, this happened from a cause which I will relate at greater length in my account of Libya, and more briefly here for now. Apries sent out an army against the Cyrenians and suffered a great defeat. The Egyptians blamed him for this and revolted against him, believing that Apries had deliberately sent them out to an obvious disaster, so that they would be destroyed and he could rule the rest of the Egyptians more securely. Those who returned from the campaign, along with the friends of those who had perished, took this so hard that they revolted openly. When Apries learned of this, he sent Amasis to them to put a stop to it by persuasion. When Amasis arrived and found the Egyptians refusing to be dissuaded, one of the Egyptians, standing behind him as he spoke, placed a helmet on his head, and in doing so declared that he was crowning him king. And this act was not at all unwelcome to Amasis, as he showed. For once those who had revolted had set him up as king of the Egyptians, he prepared to march against Apries. When Apries learned of this, he sent a man of standing among the Egyptians around him, named Patarbemis, ordering him to bring Amasis to him alive. When Patarbemis arrived and summoned Amasis, Amasis, who happened to be sitting on his horse, raised himself up and broke wind and told him to carry that back to Apries. Nevertheless, Patarbemis insisted that he come to the king, since the king had sent for him. Amasis replied that he had long been preparing to do just that, and that Apries would have no complaint against him, for he himself would come and would bring others with him too. Patarbemis, from what was said, did not fail to grasp his intention, and seeing him making preparations, hurried away, wishing to inform the king as quickly as possible of what was happening. But when he came to Apries without bringing Amasis, the king, giving him no chance to speak, in his fury ordered that his ears and nose be cut off. The rest of the Egyptians, seeing a man still loyal to the king so shamefully mutilated and disfigured, without any hesitation went over to the other side and gave themselves up to Amasis. When Apries learned of this too, he armed his mercenaries and marched against the Egyptians. He had around him 30,000 Carian and Ionian mercenaries. His palace was in the city of Sais, great and remarkable to behold. Those with Apries advanced against the Egyptians, and those with Amasis against the foreigners, and both sides came together at the city of Momphis, where they were about to test each other. There are 7 classes of Egyptians, and of these some are called priests, some warriors, some cowherds, some swineherds, some merchants, some interpreters, and some pilots. That is the number of Egyptian classes, and their names are derived from their occupations. The warriors among them are called Calasiris and Hermatibes, and they come from the following districts, for all Egypt is divided into districts. These are the districts of the Hermatibes: Busiris, Sais, Chemes, Papramis, and the island called Prosopitis, and half of Natho. From these districts come the Hermatibes, who at their most numerous numbered 160,000. None of these has learned any manual trade, but they are devoted entirely to the profession of arms. The following are the other districts of the Calasiris: Thebes, Bubastes, Aphthais, Tanis, Mendes, Sebennytis, Athribis, Pharbithis, Thmuis, Anuphis, Enesis, and Myokphorus. This district lies on an island opposite the city of Bubastes. The Calasiris occupy these districts, and at their most numerous they numbered 250,000 men. Nor are these permitted to practice any trade, but they practice only the arts of war, son succeeding father. Whether the Greeks have picked up this custom from the Egyptians too, I cannot say with confidence, seeing that the Thracians, Scythians, Persians, Lydians, and nearly all barbarians hold those citizens who learn trades, and their descendants in lower esteem than the rest, while those who have no dealings with manual crafts are considered noble, especially those devoted to war. All the Greeks have learned this practice, and the Lacedaemonians most of all. The Corinthians least of all despise craftsmen. Their privileges were the following, granted to these Egyptians alone apart from the priests: 12 exempt auroras allotted to each man. The aurora is 100 Egyptian cubits square in every direction, and the Egyptian cubit happens to be equal to the Samian cubit. These privileges were granted to all of them, but the following they enjoyed by rotation, never the same men twice. 1,000 of the Calasiris and 1,000 of the Hermatibes served each year as the king's bodyguard. These men received, apart from their auroras, the following provisions each day: 5 minas weight of baked grain, 2 minas of beef, and 4 arabal of wine each. This was given to those on guard duty at any given time. When a prize, leading his mercenaries and Amasis with all the Egyptians, came together at the city of Momphis, they joined battle, and the foreigners fought well, but being far fewer in number, they were defeated for that reason. It is said that a prize held the belief that not even a god could remove him from his kingship, so securely did he think himself established. And indeed, when he then joined battle, he was defeated and taken alive. He was led away to the city of Sais, to what had once been his own palace, but was now the palace of Amasis. There for a time he was kept in the palace, and Amasis treated him well. But in the end, when the Egyptians complained that he was not acting justly in keeping alive a man who was an enemy to both them and himself, he handed a prize over to the Egyptians. They strangled him and then buried him in the tombs of his fathers, which are in the sanctuary of Athena, very near the shrine, on the left as one enters. The Sates buried all the kings who came from this district within the sanctuary. For the tomb of Amasis, though it is farther from the shrine than that of Apries and his ancestors, is nevertheless also within the courtyard of the sanctuary, a great stone colonnade, adorned with columns carved in the likeness of palm trees and with other lavish work. Within the colonnade stand double doors, and within the doors is the burial chamber. There are also, in size, in the sanctuary of Athena, behind the temple, adjoining the whole wall of the temple, the burial place of one whose name I consider it not right to utter in connection with such a matter. And in the sacred precinct stand great stone obelisks, and there is a lake nearby, bordered with a stone rim, well made and circular, and in size, as it seemed to me, about as large as the one in Delos called the Round Lake. There, on that lake, at night, they stage the events of his suffering in a rite the Egyptians call the Mysteries. Concerning these things, though I know more precisely how each of them is done, let my lips be sealed. And concerning the rite of Demeter, which the Greeks call the Thesmophoria, on this too let my lips be sealed, except so far as it is permitted to speak of it. It was the daughters of Danaus who carried this rite forth from Egypt and passed it on to the Pelasgian women. Then, once the whole Peloponnese had been uprooted by the Dorians, the rite died out there, except that the Arcadians, the only Peloponnesians left behind and not driven out, preserved it alone. With a prize thus overthrown, Amasis became king, being from the district of Sais and from the city called Siaf. At first the Egyptians looked down on Amasis and gave him little respect, since he had previously been a commoner from an undistinguished family. But afterward Amasis won them over by cleverness, not by arrogance. There was he had countless other fine things, and among them a golden footbath in which Amasis himself and all his dinner guests used to wash their feet on every occasion. This he broke up and had made into the statue of a god, and he set it up at the most suitable spot in the city. And the Egyptians kept coming to the statue and worshipping it devoutly. When Amasis learned what the townspeople were doing, he called the Egyptians together and revealed the truth. The statue, he said, had been made from the footbath into which the Egyptians had once vomited and urinated and washed their feet, yet now they worshipped it devoutly. And so, he went on, the same thing had happened to him as to the footbath. He might once have been a commoner, but at present he was their king, and he ordered them to honor and respect him. In this way, he won the Egyptians over to accepting that it was right to serve him. As for how he ordered his affairs, it was like this. In the early morning, until the hour when the marketplace fills, he diligently transacted the business brought before him. But from then on he drank and cracked jokes at his drinking companions and was frivolous and playful. His friends, annoyed at this, admonished him, saying, "O king, you do not conduct yourself rightly, dragging yourself down to such utter frivolity. You ought to sit in state on a stately throne and transact business all day long. Then the Egyptians would know they are ruled by a great man, and you would have a better reputation. As it is, what you are doing is not at all kingly." But he answered them thus, "Those who own bows string them when they need to use them, for if they were kept strung all the time, they would snap, and then their owners could not use them at need. So it is with a man's constitution. If he chose to be serious always and never gave himself his share of play, he would go mad or fall into a stupor before he knew it. Knowing this, I give each side its portion." That was his answer to his friends. It is said of Amasis that even when he was a private man, he was fond of drinking and joking, and not at all a serious person. And whenever the means for drinking and good living ran out on him, he would go around stealing. Those who claimed he had their property, when he denied it, would haul him off to whatever oracle was in their district. Many times he was convicted by the oracles, and many times he got off. When he became king, then, he did as follows. All the gods who had acquitted him of being a thief he took no care of, and gave nothing for the upkeep of their temples, nor did he visit them to sacrifice, since they were worth nothing and possessed lying oracles. But all who had convicted him of being a thief, these he cared for most of all, on the grounds that they were true gods who delivered oracles that did not lie. First, at Sais he built for Athena a gateway that is a marvel, far surpassing everyone in its height and size, and in the size and quality of its stones. Then he dedicated great colossi and enormous mansphinxes, and brought other stones of prodigious size for repairs. He brought some of these from the quarries near Memphis, but the very largest from the city of Elephantine, a voyage of as much as 20 days from Sais. But what I marvel at not least but most of all is this. He brought a chamber of a single stone from the city of Elephantine, and the transport of it took 3 years, with 2,000 men assigned to haul it, all of them pilots. The outside length of this chamber is 21 cubits, its width 14, its height 8. Those are the outside measurements of the single stone chamber. But inside, the length is 18 cubits and a pygon, and the height is 5 cubits. It lies beside the entrance of the temple, for they say it was not dragged inside the temple for this reason. While the chamber was being hauled, the master builder groaned aloud, worn out by the work and by how much time had passed, and Amasis took this to heart and would not let it be dragged any farther. Some, however, say that a man was crushed by it, one of those levering it along, and that for this reason it was not dragged inside. Amasis also dedicated in all the other notable temples works remarkable for their size, and among them at Memphis, the Colossus lying flat before the entrance to the temple of Hephaestus, which is 75 feet long. And on the same base stand two colossi of the same stone, each 20 feet in size, one on this side and one on that side of the great one. There is another stone figure of the same size at Sais, lying in the same fashion as the one at Memphis. And it was Amasis who built for Isis the temple at Memphis, which is large and very well worth seeing. Under King Amasis, it is said, Egypt enjoyed its greatest prosperity, both in what the river gave the land and in what the land gave its people, and the inhabited cities in it then numbered in all 20,000. And it was Amasis who established for the Egyptians this law, that every Egyptian must declare to the governor of his district, every year, the source of his livelihood. And anyone who failed to do so, or could not show an honest living, was to be punished with death. Solon the Athenian took this law from Egypt and enacted it for the Athenians. They observe it to this day, for it is a law beyond reproach. Amasis became a friend of the Greeks, and among other favors he showed to certain of them, he gave those who came to Egypt the city of Naucrates to live in. And to those who did not wish to settle but came there as traders by sea, he gave sites to set up altars and precincts for the gods. The greatest of these precincts and the most famous and most frequented is called the Helenium. These are the cities that founded it jointly, of the Ionians, Chios, Teos, Phocaea, and Clazomenae, of the Dorians, Rhodes, Cnidus, Halicarnassus, and Phaselis, and of the Aeolians, Mytilene alone. The precinct belongs to these cities, and it is they who supply the officers of the trading port. Whatever other cities claim a share in it claim what does not belong to them. Apart from these, the Aeginetans founded a precinct of Zeus on their own, the Samians another of Hera, and the Milesians one of Apollo. In old times, Naucrates was the only trading port in Egypt, and there was no other. If anyone arrived at any other mouth of the Nile, he had to swear he had not come there on purpose, and after so swearing sail with his ship itself to the Canopic mouth. Or, if contrary winds made that impossible, he had to carry his cargo in barges around the delta until he reached Naucrates. Such was the honor Naucrates enjoyed. When the Amphictyons contracted for 300 talents to build the temple that now stands at Delphi, for the one previously there had burned down of itself, it fell to the Delphians to provide a quarter of the price. So the Delphians went about from city to city collecting gifts, and in doing this they brought back not the least from Egypt. Amasis gave them 1,000 talents of alum, and the Greeks living in Egypt 20 mini. With the people of Cyrene, Amasis concluded a pact of friendship and alliance, and he also decided to take a wife from there, whether from desire for a Greek woman or otherwise out of friendship for the Cyrenians. He married, at any rate, a daughter, some say of Battus, others of Arcesilaus, others of Critobulus, a man of standing among the townspeople. Her name was Lattis. Now whenever Amasis lay with her, he was unable to have intercourse, though he could with his other women. When this had gone on a long while, Amasis said to this Lattis, as she is called, "Woman, you have bewitched me, and there is no way you will escape dying the most miserable death of any woman alive." Lattis, when her denials did nothing to soften Amasis, made a vow in her heart to Aphrodite. If Amasis lay with her that very night, for that was the cure for her trouble, she would send a statue to the goddess in Cyrene. Immediately after the vow, Amasis lay with her. And from then on, each time Amasis visited her, they came together again, and afterward his affection for her grew strong. Lattis paid her vow to the goddess. She had a statue made and sent it to Cyrene, and it was still safe in my own time, standing facing outward from the city of the Cyrenians. This Lattis, when Cambyses conquered Egypt and learned from her who she was, he sent back unharmed to Cyrene. Amasis also dedicated offerings in Greece. First, at Cyrene, a gilded statue of Athena and a portrait of himself done in painting. Then, to Athena at Lindus, 2 stone statues and a linen corslet well worth seeing. And to Hera at Samos, 2 wooden images of himself, which stood in the great temple even to my own day, behind the doors. His dedication at Samos was made on account of the bond of hospitality he shared with Polycrates, son of Aeaxes. The one at Lindus owed nothing to any such tie, but rather to the fact that the temple of Athena at Lindus is said to have been established by the daughters of Danaus, who put in there when they were fleeing the sons of Aegyptus. These were the dedications of Amasis. He was also the first of men to capture Cyprus and subject it to the payment of tribute.